It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
So Preston North End, they became the first Invincibles, the first team to go, which Arsene Wenger, of course, did with Arsenal in 2004. But I think Preston North End did it in 1888. And of course, that inspired other northern clubs. So that's why the North became the real dominant force, because for their players, for their teams, football did offer an alternative life and a much more prosperous life and a much more fulfilling life. Whereas down south, the likes of Charles Alcock and those other teams, you know, the Engineers, the Wanderers, they were Corinthians. They were still very much amateur, middle, upper middle class, gentlemen, playing it for the love of the sport and that sort of, you know, the Victorian ideals of manhood, etc., and not for money.
Hello and welcome to the pod. Today's episode is on the history of English football with Gavin Mortimer. There's lots to discuss, including football's origins, the different social classes and their approach to football, the changes in transportation and technology which spread the game, the absence of women's football, and we talk about the impact of the two world wars. At my school, I played a primitive form of football, and I put a link in the show notes for the rules, as well as Gavin's book, which I've definitely read, and ways to get in touch with me as well. Gordon will be returning next Saturday with World War I British Commanders, and we've responded to listeners' comments on that, so please keep them coming. We're going to be carrying on into the Victorian era with more British Commanders. Now, just quickly, if you want to know a little bit more about me, there is a link to an interview I took part in with a very talented podcaster. It's called Growing Up with Delia Burgess. There are plenty of great interviews on there that are far more interesting than me, so do give it a go. Anyway, plenty more great history to come, so if you can give me a 5-star rating, that would be fantastic. But until then, I'll hand you over to me, talking with Gavin Mortimer on the history of English football. Gavin, welcome back. Last time you were on, we were talking, well, it was a discussion with Tom Petch that didn't end in rude words, which was a win for me. But this
struggle, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But it did really well, actually. People like that. But today is the history of football. And I wanted to talk to you because you wrote this book, History of Football in 100 Objects, which I think it wasn't a FIFA. You didn't get a suitcase of cash from Sepp Blatter for this, did you? This wasn't an official FIFA. This is a more football association football anniversary, isn't it?
Related? Yeah, I mean, it wasn't commissioned. I certainly didn't get any a suitcase of cash. More's the pity. But no, it was not an authorised book, which of course was great because it allowed me to be quite, you know, it's a little bit, it's history, but with a little sort of a wry smile, because particularly the way that football is now, it's a sport, but it's also show business. But it was fascinating from a historical point of from sort of wearing my two loves of sport and history. And it was fascinating from a historian's point of view, just to see how football evolved 150 years ago.
Yeah. And so I think probably many listeners are familiar with maybe the sort of early football clubs that competed for the FA Cup probably in the late 1880s, 1890s. But going further back, should we start right at the beginning, you know, where you get, okay, we all know it was a pig's bladder booted around a medieval town and everyone, basically it was an excuse to have a bit of a ruck, bit of a fight. But then it evolved in the public schools. I'm getting that roughly right, aren't I?
Yeah, you are getting that roughly right. And actually, talking of Sepp Blatter, of course, it was Sepp Blatter who, I think it's fair to say, had a rather strained relationship with the British, particularly the English, who, during his time as FIFA president, said the Chinese invented football, which they didn't. The Chinese, like, as you mentioned, the medieval English and the medieval French, would rush around in their hundreds kicking a sort of a pig's bladder or some sort of object resembling a ball. But it was not football as we know it. It was just simply kicking something down the street. That's right. It was, I suppose, you know, Thomas Arnold, the headmaster of rugby from 1828 to about the 1842. And his approach and that this whole ethos of a Victorian time of muscular Christianity, a healthy body equals a healthy mind. And of course, taking young men's minds off the opposite sex, etc., and getting them to run around. And so these things came together and in the middle of the 19th century. And so football began to take shape as we know it. There began to be rules. And I suppose there one of the real driving forces was a chap called Charles Alcock. And he organised a meeting at the Freemasons Tavern in 1863 to draw up a list of rules to bring some sort of order to these games, which could, you know, go on for, they've been played in the public schools, crucially too, in the north of England, particularly Sheffield, and you'd have groups of young men, and they'd be sort of organised, the rules were beginning to come through, they're organised into two teams, you know, anything up 20, 30 aside. I mean, it could last for a couple of hours without anyone actually scoring a goal because wasn't really decided on what constituted the goal. So Charles Alcock met with some very middle class at this tavern in London, 1863, drew up some rules. Around about the same time, the Sheffield Association, much more working class, were also working on some rules. And the sort of the two, to cut a long story short, combined, produced the Football Association. I mean, really, very rapidly, that an extraordinary creative time in terms of footballing terms. The 1860s, the 1870s, the clubs began to emerge. Sheffield United, Sheffield Wednesday, Notts County, and then Arsenal down south, Woolwich Arsenal. And of course, then you had the first FA Cup. The Wanderers beat the Engineers 1-0. And the same year, 1872, was the first international England-Scotland, Queen's Park in Glasgow being the powerhouse in Scotland. And then it took off. And of course, the Welsh and the Irish associations formed. And Britain was very much at the forefront of the development of football, but it caught on so quickly. And just an extraordinary time for not just football, of course, but for other organised sport. Because what a decade for a sports lover, the 1870s. You had the first football international in 1872, 1871, the first rugby international, England and Scotland. And of course, 1877, as every cricket buff will tell you, first Ashes test, England and Australia. So, yeah, wow, what a time. Tennis too, what a time to be alive.
It just makes you think how miserable life was before the 1870s.
It's true, isn't it? I mean, It's you sort of had, you know, for the toffs, to use that vernacular, you had, you know, hunting and a fishing and jousting going back a bit further. But that's right. If you wanted to be if you're a working class lad wanting to let off steam in the early 1800s, for, you know, out of a factory, all you could do was chase a pig's bladder down the street.
Yes. I've read a few biographies, and maybe this is probably a bit later, actually, because you start seeing clubs being set up abroad, and I don't want to dwell on that too long, but I'd read a very interesting book on Barcelona and Athletic Bilbao and then I think other clubs in northern Italy, and they're all set up by British businessmen who've travelled abroad and set up their own club there. And so it's not only a growth in Britain, it's a growth on the continent thanks to those Brits who've taken I suppose the rules and their structures abroad with them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose that actually the best example is Charles Miller, who went to Brazil in 1894. And Corinthians, the great Brazilian club, are named after the Corinthians, the the English club. And they also, I think it was a Scottish expat who went to Argentina and started the game. So, yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's not being sort of jingoistic. It is just saying that the British, with their love of travelling at this, well, still, but particularly at that time, a lot of British expats working abroad, and they took their love of sport with them. And, well, certainly, alas, from a footballing point of view, we gave the game to the Brazilians and the Italians. And what did they do? They threw it back in our faces by beating us on a regular basis. So it's an extraordinary, again, just to see how quickly this game spread. And, yeah, if you compare it to rugby, it's interesting, isn't it? I always think it's fascinating to compare, and cricket too, the development from a global perspective of cricket and rugby, which were very much stayed within the British Empire. So India and obviously Australia, New Zealand, India, later Pakistan and the West Indies, of course, cricket, and then rugby, South Africa, New Zealand and Australia, the three powerhouses, and Samoa, Fiji, etc. But if you look at football, how football just took off everywhere. And I think that's the real advantage and the strength that football has today over rugby. If you look at the football World Cups, you have, look at the most recent World Cup, Morocco reached the semi-final, and you have South Korea and Mexico and all these teams, Iran, and reach, you know, getting into the World Cup final and doing well. Whereas at rugby, it's still very much, unfortunately, dominated the quarterfinals, and nearly, you know, we get excited if Fiji make the quarterfinals. But otherwise, it's always the same old oppositions making the same old teams making the quarterfinals. So that's the beauty of football. It's such an easy game to understand.
And yeah, it's the simplicity then. That's why it's grown. It's not because administrators, because I have a lot of problems with the cricket administrators. It's not down to administrators wanting to keep the game within their own control and not wanting to see it spread globally.
No, I think in football it's such an easy game to understand. That's obviously a problem for rugby and to an extent cricket. It's just such a basic game, isn't it? You know, there are two goals. You got to put this ball in the back of the net. And if you look at, I'm always amazed. I suppose rugby is really my game. I'm amazed that even if you watch England's World Cup victory 20 years ago, 2003, you'll see how the physique of the players has changed. If you go back, I mean, if you go back just recently, we're talking to you just a few days after the sad death of Barry John, the great Welsh fly half. And there's been a couple of clips of him doing the rounds on social media. And, you know, it's just it's a different world. He's, you know, they're all just small blokes, really. You know, you get a couple of, you know, fairly big lads, but by today's standards, the big lads back then would be playing in the backs today. If you look at football players, it's still very much a game. The physique doesn't really come into it. You still get a lot of it. Look at Messi. You know, he's a small lad, no different in size really from someone like Pelé or Maradona or Tom Finney going back further, etc. So, it hasn't changed that much. And I think that's that is something that makes it more accessible than rugby or cricket.
So perhaps you can clear something up for me then. You mentioned Notts County. And I think I was reading through your book, because most people would probably assume that that's the oldest football club in the world. And that's, it's true to a certain extent. But the Sheffield FC is sort of a rival to that title, isn't it?
Yeah, I think Notts County is the oldest club still in existence. I think Sheffield then went and changed, was it's not the Sheffield United or Sheffield Wednesday as we know it. If I'm wrong in that, we're going to be inundated with furious Sheffield fans, but that's certainly, Notts County like to think of itself as the oldest club in existence. And it's interesting that very much the northern clubs and the midland clubs were the dominant forces. And it wasn't really until Herbert Chapman took over at Arsenal in 1925, I think, that London became a strong club. Tottenham had some success before the First World War, but it was Arsenal who really became, for a period of, well, from the sort of the late 20s throughout until the Second World War, the dominant club in England, and being a a southern club. That was a change from a past where it had been dominated by the clubs from Liverpool, from Manchester, from Sheffield, etc., from Nottingham. And that was very much, I think, tied in with professionalism, and therefore it was still very much, you know, resorting to cliches, but a true cliche in this case, that the northern clubs were more working class, and for them, of course, it was professional, and the southern clubs were still had a rather gentlemanly ethos to them. And it was Herbert Chapman who made Arsenal professional and hard-nosed, introduced shirt numbers, introduced tactics, and of course he changed the name of Gillespie Road to the tube station to Arsenal, and very modern in his approach, and in a way was the first really modern manager. And that was good for the game, because it gave a power base in London, and of course today, you know, London and the northern clubs in Liverpool and Manchester in particular are the three dominant areas in the country.
And just diving into the sort of class issue as well, I mean, Alcock, because these public schools had a sort of primitive form of football and they were all different. Now, I have to make a confession here. I did play one of those forms of football at my school, and it was a little bit like the modern football that we know, but you weren't allowed to pass the ball forward. You could only dribble, and then that would mean you would have all your teammates would effectively create a kind of guard, and then your opponents would have to come in, and basically it would turn into a bit of a ruck, not dissimilar to the medieval sort. Yeah. And so there were sort of fairly low scoring games. It was actually one of the few sports I was any good at, Gavin, which is typical when it's the only place you can play it is when you have to finish at 18.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was it that Alcock really tried? Because I guess they were quite influenced by rugby as well. Was Alcock really just trying to say, look, you know, come on, this is all so disorganised. We all need to be playing the same sport here. Is that basically what he was saying?
That's basically what it is. And I think, too, distinguishing themselves from rugby, which was also developing at this time. And as we mentioned earlier, the first rugby international was a year before. So no doubt that the likes of Alcock and a lot of the southern gentlemen came from the same background as the rugby innovators and knew each other. And there was an element of competition. But while they wanted rules, it was still very much amateur. Whereas for the northern teams, they saw it as a way of making money, and this happened quite quickly, even escaping their fairly, a life of hardship, really. A lot of them worked in the mills and in mines, and suddenly they had the opportunity of making a few bob playing football. And the man who was instrumental in that was Billy Siddle at Preston, who was a mill owner. And he got hold of Preston North End, became the owner, became the manager. And in fact, I probably did him a misservice when I said Herbert Chapman was the first manager as we know it today. I'd say that Billy Siddle was, and he had a rather paternal regard towards his players. He would get them to cut down on their drinking, to stop their drinking, even watch what they ate. An early Arsene Wenger, etc. And it paid off, because no other club was doing this. So Preston North End, they became the first Invincibles, the first team to go, which Arsene Wenger, of course, did with Arsenal in 2004. But I think Preston North End did it in 1888. And of course, that inspired other northern clubs. So that's why the North became the real dominant force, because for their players, for their teams, football did offer an alternative life and a much more prosperous life and a much more fulfilling life. Whereas down south, the likes of Charles Alcock and those other teams, you know, the Engineers, the Wanderers, they were Corinthians. They were still very much amateur, middle, upper middle class, gentlemen, playing it for the love of the sport and that sort of, you know, the Victorian ideals of manhood, etc., and not for money.
And you were saying before we started recording, which is really interesting, about around the development of the train networks throughout the country was also hugely important in the development of the game.
Yeah, I think that is particularly crucial, because and also not just allowing players to travel further afield to play, and that includes going to Scotland to play, but allowing fans to follow their team. So this really started And it was amazing how quickly it spread. And so, and the train companies, of course, cottoned on to this very quickly and would offer match day packages. And soon that grew to a whole weekend package. When the FA Cup started, come down to London for the weekend, you'll get your ticket, hotel included, etc. And so the supporters loved that. Third factor, Ollie, was the half day holiday, the half day on a Saturday. So the factories, the mills, etc., they would stop work at lunchtime on a Saturday. That allowed players to play and supporters to support. And they could then travel on the trains to follow their team. And so very quickly, and you know, bear in mind that the entertainment on offer to us today is just, you know, it's ceaseless. Back then, there wasn't much entertainment for particularly sort of on one afternoon for the more disadvantaged members of society. And suddenly they had the chance to go and see their football team. And the football club was very representative of the town, whether it was Preston, Accrington, Stanley, Oldham, whoever it might be. And so there was a real pride in going to see their boys play. And the other thing worth saying is that it's women's football now, which is really enjoying. I was about to say, it is a boom, but it's not the first boom, because women's football was very popular.
Yeah, it was huge, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. In the late 19th, early 20th century, and particularly during the First World War, when there were no men's football, and they would get huge crowds going to the women's game. Great players.
And when we say huge crowds, we're talking sort of 60,000.
Absolutely, in the big stadiums. And it just, it's odd how it just sort of tailed away completely because the 20s was a decade of great emancipation for women in many, in, you know, socially and at the workplace. The first woman, a quick plug, I've written about this, the great swim, Gertrude Edley, first woman to swim the English Channel in 1926. Men thought a woman could never swim the Channel. She not only swam it, she swam it in a time that no man had, the fastest time ever up to that point, beating any man, men's time. But women's football just sort of...
Well, it was banned, wasn't it, until...
It was banned for a while, yeah, that's right.
1970, I think, as late as...
Well,
when it was banned in 1921, the FA said the game of football is quite unsuitable for females and ought not to be encouraged, which... It's just mad.
And of course, it was only, I think I mentioned this in the book, actually. It was 20 years ago, 2004, that Sepp Blatter said a good idea for women's football would be if they wore tighter shorts to make it more appealing. I mean, we're only talking 2004 when he said this nonsense. And it's wonderful to see how women's football has just completely exploded, not just in Britain, but around the world in the last 5 years. And you know, you get, as you saw in the last couple of tournaments, the crowds going now are comparable to the men's game.
So one thing I wanted to talk about, the most important object, is the ball. Mm-hmm. And so we've mentioned the sheep's bladder, but how did the ball evolve? Because, I mean, nowadays, the balls sort of almost, they seem to go in all sorts of directions depending on the weight of the ball now. And you're always hearing footballers complaining about the ball. But in the early days, we're talking leather, aren't we?
We are. I'm just looking at, actually, as we speak. I hate to say it, I'm old enough to remember playing in my youth, i.e. as a nipper, with one of those old leather that had, I'm looking up, because it started off with about 12 panels, and people of a certain vintage will know what I'm talking about.
Is that where it's a sort of rectangular strip?
Yeah,
sort of four of those.
Exactly, stitched together. And I also remember playing at school with a leather rugby ball, which was just like soap when it got wet. And no matter how good your hand-eye coordination was, you go to catch it and it would just like a bar of soap. And heading a football, I mean, you know, we laugh about it, but the cases of old players getting dementia and being attributed to heading a football, I can well believe it, because I remember playing junior football, heading a wet leather football, and it was, you know, your head would ring. It was like getting punched in the face by a boxer. It was that hard. It was actually, of course, one of the first people who was tasked with creating a football was Charles Goodyear of the famous rubber company. And at first they used 7 panels of leather, and then it went up to 12 panels. The first 24 panels, the 1966 World Cup football was 24 panels stitched together. The first 1970, it was a 32 panel. And then it was in 1986, was the first entirely synthetic material to be used. And ever since then, of course, they've been about, I mean, I remember the 2010 World Cup, there were a lot of complaints, particularly from goalkeepers. It would sort of curve in the air like a Beckham free kick. And even if it was just hit sort of a tap back from a defender. And yeah, there's always complaints, but it is, it's very interesting just to see the development of a football. And of course, the development of the boots too. Is it Craig Johnson, the former Liverpool player, who I think it was a Predator, wasn't it? About 25 years ago now, and how...
He'd be longer, wouldn't he? He'd be 80s.
25. He played in the 80s, but I think he developed the Predator.
Oh, I see.
The Predator boot. If you go into a football museum and you see what the old boots were like, oh my God, it's just amazing. And you just see the talent of the players back then, so wearing what are basically sort of DMs.
They went up above the ankle, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right, they did, yeah. And
so it's only really in the sort of 60s, 70s, they are phasing those ones out then?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, Ollie, because in a way, we talked about the 1870s was a period, sort of the mid-1860s to the late 1880s, when football really evolved as we know it today. I mean, I think probably the other period of great evolution was the same sort of time from the 70s to the 90s. And football became sexy, to use a dreadful word in that context.
But Rude Hullet description there.
Well, yeah.
Sexy football.
And of course, before that, not just how you played it, but before that, you had the likes of George Best, Frank Worthington, Stan Bowles. It became when footballers became celebrities, and of course the money began to flow into it, because companies began to see the sponsor it. And I think, and then we talked about how the trains opened up football within a country, and then of course planes opened up football globally in the 60s. A bit earlier, of course, in the 50s. But in the mid-50s, you had the launch of a European Cup. And then thereafter, air travel began to get cheaper, particularly in the 80s. So fans could go abroad and support their teams, because in the 50s and early 60s, when teams would go abroad to play in the European Cup, they wouldn't really have any away fans with them. That changed in the 70s and the 80s. Of course, one of the unpleasant offshoots was hooliganism. What they used to call the English disease in the late 70s and early 80s. So you had the development of both the football, of boots, and how players began to train and look after themselves. And with that came the money. And the game now really is, certainly in terms of financial remuneration, is entirely different from what it was in the 80s. And if I may just tell you a quick story, I am, for my sins, a lifelong Arsenal fan.
I was going to ask this question at some point.
I'm a lifelong Arsenal fan. And I remember the first time I went to see the Arsenal was in the late 70s, when I was knee-high to a grasshopper. This was in the period, Ollie, when, if there's any Arsenal fans of my age or older watching, they will remember this. There was the singing policeman. So a member of the Met Police would sing a song just as the team's ran out. So that's how sort of quaint it was. My junior football team, our coach had been on the books at Arsenal when a teenager and as a youth player, and he still was in contact with he knew some of the staff at Arsenal. This would have been about 1980, I think. And he organized for our team to have a tour of the stadium. So we had a tour of the stadium. This was before such things were common. It was a private tour. I mean, afterwards we met the players and got their autographs as they finished training. This was the great Arsenal team.
Liam Brady?
Yeah, oh, Chippy, yeah. David O'Leary, Pat Rice, Pat Jennings, Alan Sunderland. My hero, the great Irish striker, Frank Stapleton, like me, a number nine. Now, he wasn't, so I got everyone's autograph, but I couldn't see Big Frank. I said, oh, where's Frank? Where's Frank? And I think I think it was David O'Leary, said, oh, Frank goes out the back because he gets the bus home. So I ran out the back of the stadium. And I remember there was Frank Stapleton waiting at the bus stop for the number, whatever bus. And I ran up to him and said, can I have your autograph, please, Mr. Stapleton? And he was very nice, gave me his autograph. But I think of it often and laugh to myself. I mean, imagine going a day and finding,
Saka.
Yes, Saka or Gabriel Jesus waiting for the number 12 outside the Emirates. And but that's what it was. You know, they were just... when you read of some footballers from that era and earlier, you know, on hard times having to sell their medals, and you think, oh, goodness me, someone like Saka could retire tomorrow and he would never have to work again.
Yeah, and I guess the health, I mean, you mentioned the ball, and Jeff Assel was a famous victim of the heavy ball.
But my favourite, actually, I was thinking about this just coming on, my favourite, it's the Radio Times, and 1927, January 27, the first live radio commentary was between Arsenal and Sheffield United. Arsenal was also the first live TV game, or the first TV game to be broadcast. Why Arsenal? Because the BBC then were located in Alexandra Palace, just up the road from the Arsenal. So it's a case of quickly tackle your gear and go up to Highbury. And what they did was to allow listeners to follow the game, they printed in the Radio Times a diagram of the Highbury pitch divided into eight squares. And so listeners could have their Radio Times in front of them, and the commentator would commentate the match referring to the squares. So you had square 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And so, for example, I just printed an extract of a commentary. It ran as follows. Oh, pretty work. Very pretty. Square 5. Now upfield. Oh, a pretty pass. Square 5.8. Come on, Mercer. Now then, Mercer. Oh, hello. Nobby's got it. Square 1.2. So that's how the commentary went. And everyone would be following it, so they knew where the football was, where the play was, on their diagram of printed in the Radio Times. And that, incidentally, is the origin of a phrase, back to square one. Because they would then say, oh, and it's back to square one.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I love little quirky histories like that. And but again, yeah, I mean, it just shows you how that's nearly 100 years ago. And you know, the media coverage of football now, it's so sophisticated. And it's interesting, actually, Ollie, because I wrote the book, I think it was published in 2013, and there's no mention at the very end. One of the last objects is about technology, microchip, because they were just at that point putting a microchip into footballs to know that, to allow them to tell if it was over the line. Because England fans will well remember at the 2010 World Cup in South Africa, Frank Lampard's shot against Germany hit the underside of a bar. German fans will be screaming, ha! That's what happened to us.
Yes. 1966.
Exactly. Yeah, it was over the line, but it wasn't given. So the microchip was introduced. But also I mentioned it was then referred to as Hawkeye, like in cricket and tennis. There was no mention, though, of VAR. So that hadn't yet, the famous VAR, the scourge of football fans up and down the country who always think their team's been robbed by VAR, that hadn't come into existence yet. And it's funny, isn't it, now that it's such an integral and controversial part of the game. But even just, you know, 11 years ago, no one knew what the joy and the agony of VAR had yet to be visited on us.
Well, I hope the listeners can indulge us going off on a little tangent here, but I hate VAR, and I support Southampton, and we got relegated last year, and being in the Championship this year is just wonderful with no VAR. I mean, I'm probably in a minority, but I'd rather hope that we don't get promoted just because it's awful. I think that it just seems to be used randomly with no real logic behind it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I mean, let's take Arsenal this season. It's You know, I think it probably evens out most of the time. But what I find it stops you from doing is actually celebrating a goal if there's any doubt in it there and then. Because there was a case on Saturday, I think Saka, Arsenal Liverpool, Saka scored the first Arsenal goal and it was VAR checked to see if he was offside when he put the ball in the net. And so I was watching it at home and I was sitting on my sofa thinking, oh, is it? And he looked at first eye, he looked, it was going to be okay. But it just sort of takes that joy out of leaping up in the air and thinking, yes, you've scored. You sort of now leap up in the air. I mean, you face an agonizing, or in some cases, it could be the, you know, if you're a Liverpool fan, you're sort of going, oh, let it be offside. But it just takes that sort of, yeah, that instinctive emotion out of the game. And I'm sort of, yeah, tempted to agree. And I think rugby, it can be more difficult to tell if a try's been scored. So I think under a pile of bodies, etc. But I think even in rugby, the video technology has been used too often. Now, coming back to a try's being disallowed for a forward pass like a minute before in the lead up, which I don't think is right. I think it should be used just to decide if a try has been scored. But it's an interesting one. But then, of course, cricket fans will tell you, well, it's been, although we're talking to you after John Crawley's controversial dismissal against India. It's you know, there's, you could argue for and against.
John Crawley, that's a blast from the past.
Right, John Crawley, Zach Crawley,
Yes.
even out against India in the second innings of a second test. Yeah, John Crawley. Yeah, it's technology. Yeah, it all still on the plus side, Ollie. It's given sports fans something to moan about in the pub for eternity.
I don't know if because I didn't get this far in your book, and we can edit part of this so that the listeners don't know that. But the pub, how important is that to the evolution of football, or is it not important?
I don't think it is particularly important. No, I think the train was more important to bringing fans together. But I mean, it is interesting in that the pub, I suppose, is associated with watching the games on a big screen, and that was really revolutionised by Sky. And we talked earlier about how the 80s saw football become popular. What made it a middle, not a, it didn't make it a middle class game, but it made it much, it opened it up to the middle classes, was Italia 1990 and Pavarotti. And there became actually a bit of sophistication with the way that the game was marketed. It was broadcast by Sky. And of course, at the same time, you had Nick Hornby's Fever Pitch, which is in the book, because I think that was another important moment for making the game. Now, of
Is
course,
that because you're an Arsenal fan?
it is because I'm an Arsenal fan, but it's also because I think TV companies realized that they had a whole new audience before them. And so Sky was willing to put much more to put much more money into it, and other broadcasters were then forced to follow suit. But of course, the downside to that is, of course, one could say that led to what Roy Keane famously described as the prawn sandwich brigade. In other words, the corporate football fan who aren't really fans, one might say, and go there just to be seen at the football. And they forced up ticket prices, and in the process forced out a lot of middle class fans. And so if you are a father or a mother on a low income wage with two kids who wants to go and see Liverpool or Man City or Arsenal or whoever it may be, even Southampton, it's increasingly hard. Whereas I still remember in my youth just rocking up at Highbury and buying a ticket on the day for Arsenal for about a fiver, I think it was, going to see Arsenal Man United back in the 80s. Those days are long gone, and I think that's a shame, because I think it has the game has moved away from its roots to a worrying degree.
And just going back a bit, during the war periods, so in the First World War and the Second World War, matches They weren't suspended in the First World War. They weren't suspended immediately, were they?
No, well, that's a really good point, Ollie, actually. And it's something that one of the objects I mentioned in the book, it's the Lord Kitchener, Your Country Needs You poster. Because when the First World War broke out in August 1914, rugby immediately ceased. It was just before the season started, but rugby abandoned the upcoming season and encouraged all men to enlist. My former club, London Scottish Rugby Club in Richmond, South London, I always remember going to training and walking past the war memorial, this large plaque, and on it were listed the names of the London Scottish players who had been killed in the First World War, a huge number. And in fact, I think there was one round of matches in August 1914 before all rugby was ceased. And London Scottish put out four 15s, 60 players. 45 of those players were killed in the war. Phenomenal.
Three of the teams basically killed. But
basically three of the teams, that's right. And on the Scotland-England Five Nations match in March 1914, six Scots and five English were killed in the war. So again, you know, more than a third of the players. Rugby was amateur. So it was easy to do that. There were no contracts to get out of. Football made the decision to keep going with the 14-15 season, but it did allow players, professional players, or players who weren't contracted to join up if they wish. 2,000 out of 5,000 players enlisted. Some of those who didn't were, their clubs didn't let them. The season was progressing, and so they said, no, you've signed a contract, we're holding you to the contract. One of those was Charlie Buchan of Arsenal. At the time, I beg your pardon, he was playing for Sunderland at the time. So he played the 14-15 season, and then as soon as the 15 season was over, the Football League closed down, suspended the league. He joined the Grenadier Guards and was awarded the military medal at the Battle of Cambrai in 1917. Nonetheless, the fact that football didn't immediately stop playing became a point of great controversy. There were letters in the Times saying it was an outrage, that the players are cowards and shirkers, etc. Look at the sacrifice of rugby. And after the war, this had grave ramifications, because before the war, most public schools played football, and some exclusively football, some football and rugby. But because of the tardiness with which the Football League had responded to the outbreak of war, to enlistment, they said football is not the game for upstanding young men. Rugby is the game for us. 111 rugby internationals were killed in the war. So they shunned football, and rugby became the sport of the public schools. And it continued, really, I would say, until, I know that football is making a comeback now in a lot of public schools in the UK. If anyone from America or overseas watching, when I say public schools, that's what we mean by private schools. And it's only really in the last 10 years that that football's making a comeback in private schools. But you know, for 100 years, football was regarded as a rather, that's right.
Even though in the Second World War, then the Football Association learnt its lesson, because I think they stopped as soon as war was declared, didn't they?
Yeah, they did, and a great many other professionals. I interviewed, for one book I wrote about the Second World War, I interviewed the great Tom Finney, Preston North End in England.
You've actually met Tom Finney?
I didn't meet him. He wasn't well enough to meet in person, but we spoke on the phone.
Oh, wonderful.
This would have been about 20 years ago. Because the book I was writing was about the heaviest bombing raid on London and the war was May the 10th, the evening of May the 10th, 1941. And it so happened that the services FA Cup final was being played. So everyone playing it was Arsenal, Preston, and Tom Finney, who was playing for Preston, who was joined up, was stationed in the UK. He was able to play in it. So he was just sharing his memories of the... I think if I remember rightly, it ended in a 1-1 draw and had to go to a replay. It wasn't an official cup final; it was a war.
Yeah. I was going to say, I thought if they'd suspended football, how come you've
of course, that's another point. Ollie, going back to the First World War, that and you know, they learned the lesson there. And we mentioned about the success of women's football, because the people on the home front, people working in the munitions factory, or just, you know, engaged in very important work on the home front, they needed some entertainment. And suddenly, just stop every sport. How are people going to take their minds off a war? Just relax. So in the Second World War, while they suspended the Football League, they had misapplied to rugby too. They had a lot of wartime internationals featuring the England, the Scotland, the Wales, Northern Ireland, stars of their day, whether it was rugby or football and cricket too, playing in front of big crowds with the proceeds going to the war effort. And these were hugely successful. So it was seen as very good for keeping up morale on the home front.
Interesting. This has been great, Gavin. I could talk about this forever, probably.
I mean, I think it's interesting, as I'm talking to you from France, I think it's worth mentioning the contribution of the French to football. Because
I'm desperate to regain my lost French listeners, actually. So, yes,
okay,
let's
well,
do this.
Of course, Jules Rimet was the man responsible for the World Cup. And then it was, now we shouldn't forget the English, the British were wonderfully xenophobic at this stage. They didn't compete in the first World Cup or the first two World Cups in 34, 38, because it was beneath them playing South Americans and Johnny Foreigners in general. I mean, of course, when they did compete in the World Cup in 1950, they got humiliated by America. And I mentioned that, in fact, it's a New York taxi, because the man who scored the only goal of a game in that 1-0 defeat by the States was a taxi driver. And then it was a Frenchman whose name escaped me for the moment, begins with a G, who had the idea of the European Cup, or of a European competition in the 1950s. I think he worked for L'Equipe, if I remember rightly, and he was getting a little bit fed up with English teams boasting that England was the great footballing nation, even though they were being humiliated by America, by Hungary, by everyone at this stage. And so he thought, well, okay, then let's organise a European competition, and we'll see how good the English really are. And so began the European Cup. And of course, the English teams really struggled in the first few years. You had Celtic winning the European Cup in 67, and then 70s began a period of dominance with Liverpool in particular, Aston Villa, Notts Forest. And so there was the Frenchmen who were responsible for the
Gabriel Hano, I think.
Yeah, that's it. Right. And the European Cup. So yeah, good for the French. But it is funny how snooty the British were at first about we've invented the game. No one's going to play us at it. We're just going to keep it among ourselves. And of course, when they did open it up, we rapidly discovered that people loved beating us and beat us quite regularly.
I think as we speak, England have had the best success since 1966 in World Cup finals. So you never know. It might happen next time.
It may. I'm not very optimistic, I have to say, but at least we've reached a final for the first time since 1966. I mean, it is appalling, really, that talking from an English point of view, that England have only ever won a World Cup once. When you think how obsessed the country is with the nation is with the game, how many people play the game, the strength of our Premier League, and we certainly should, with this young generation that we've got of players, Bellingham, Saka, etc. But we'll see. Big test for Gareth Southgate. I think that you know, he's proved himself a good manager, but he needs to prove himself a great manager, and you only do that by winning international tournaments.
Well, we'll leave that for the listeners who are supporting England, and for the remainder, of which there are quite a considerable number, Gavin, they'll be hoping that that doesn't happen. But Gavin, this has been fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you, Ollie. Pleasure.
And perhaps, because I know you've written about cricket as well, perhaps when you've had a rest and gathered your thoughts, we could do cricket or maybe even rugby as well. But thank you so much for coming on.
Pleasure.
Thanks so much for listening. Please do get in touch if you've got any comments. The Film Club continues next week with Public Enemies and Bonnie and Clyde. But until then, thank you and good night.